Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, February 4, 2012. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic for today is Be Human. Go for killing off green ideology, and we do mean to succeed in this. Now, what the panel we have to discuss this of two guests is very international today, I'm glad to say. And let me introduce them right now. We're linking up United States and Australia. From here in the Midwest, from Detroit, we welcome Bill Roberts. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Marcia.
And you know, most of you will know Bill from the Slate of Six, the presidency slate that's taking the leadership responsibility for the policies we must have and intervening on the scene in the United States, which is very dismal if you think of the figures in the official election campaign. We can get to that later. But Bill is running as a candidate for Congress among the, when I say Slate of Six, along with five others running for office in different parts of the country. And I hope you've all seen him in the, I think it's three, right, Bill? Panel discussions with Mr. LaRouche and your fellow candidates in the last 3 weeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
On LaRouchePAC.com. So this is, those three forums I recommend highly. They're on the site. But first, let me welcome from Melbourne, Australia, from down under, Robbie Barwick. Welcome, Robbie.
G'day, Marcia.
And Robbie is a leader in the Citizens Electoral Council, an institution of critical importance that's been around for years. Robbie could talk about it more if he wishes to, in Australia, on the scene there, playing also a leadership role amidst a dismal scene of those officially in office. But the CEC, the Citizens Electoral Council, is a co-thinker group with Mr. LaRouche's collaborators internationally. Robbie's the policy director, and I recommend, what's especially one of the reasons we ask you to be on, Robbie, that people can look at about an hour-long special video you can see on their website. It's circulating in DVD in Australia. Robbie, is the name Ecosystems Genocide Fraud?
Yeah, Ecosystems are Genocidal Fraud.
And I'll say it now and repeat it throughout, but it's simple. The website is CECAUS, that is standing for Citizens Electoral Council Australia, CECAUST.com.au.
.au, yeah.
So let me, by way of a brief introduction to the topic, before we definitely want to go to Bill Roberts about the latest kind of situation report on things. What I'd like to do, Bill and Robbie and listeners, is I want to mention a few benchmarks in the precursors to the strategic danger we're now in, threat of war, the breakdown of the economy, meaning in terms of very physical basics, food, disease, no sanitation, and complete vulnerability to just even floods and drought, let alone asteroids and earthquakes. So with that, let me just remind people, this year, 2012, it marks two anniversaries. It's the 20th anniversary of the Rio de Janeiro conference called Earth Summit back in 1992. And that was heads of state. That was a gathering that shouldn't have taken place, but its outlook, which Robbie, I'm sure, will be talking about in many respects, was such that, well, resources are fixed and inevitably scarce. We're running out of things. You all have to cut back, nations and peoples. It's the end of the line. You know, that kind of worse than pessimism. But Robbie, I think you mentioned in your video, 40 years ago, 1972, was a famous Stockholm conference, it was called. That's back in my day of being relatively young and taking notice of things. That wasn't necessarily heads of state, but it was like the first big environmentalist conference.
And it did include heads of state as well, including people from China.
Oh.
But it was this Club of Rome, organized, well, not so much organized, but it was very much influenced by the Club of Rome's alarmist warnings at the time.
So those two benchmarks, I'm getting around to say that just that all of this, as I say, our guests will be talking about, it's part of kind of conditioning, mind control, policy imposition that goes right along with the monetarist system that's best called the British Empire, that's now collapsing anyway of its own nature. You have misery, you have hunger and disease, and we're going to get to the British Empire imperial pedigree behind it. But this week, for the conference, there's a New Earth Summit coming up in June. I forget where it's going to be, Robbie, South Africa or maybe somewhere else.
They call it Rio Plus 20, I think.
Okay, Rio Plus 20, and a 100-page report was issued by the special United Nations high-level task force that the Secretary-Director Ban Ki-moon set up, I think, in 2010, and it had heads of state and other people, like the complete British concoction called Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, to the United Nations, and other people associated with this report, which was called something like Planetary Resilience, Choosing the Future. And this 100-page mess just calls on, doesn't bear discussing, of course, but indicative among the many lists of things. It says we have to start doing things like having people in Africa, instead of burning charcoal in their cook stoves, they can switch to ethanol made from cassava. I mean, this is way over the top in any way you want to look at it. That's a literal recommendation of theirs. I'm not making it up. Kevin Rudd was part of this. Robbie can talk about that. But the point is we have to, science is deadly to all of this. All of this has been an anti-science, anti-human race, anti-creativity era, and we can and we're mobilizing with science to reverse it all. Now, one thing I'll just throw out, and then Bill, I'll turn it over to you, is Mr. LaRouche is going all out and he's going to have an international webcast on February 6th. That's Monday, our time. Eastern time at 7 p.m. Monday, February 6th. I'm just saying that, Robbie, because good morning to you. It's going to be February 7th in Australia.
That's right.
But I think that the title, more or less, of Mr. LaRouche's February 6th, 7 p.m. address is The Great Threat We Must Conquer. Nobody will survive this. And that'll be on LaRouchePack.com. I'll mention it again. So, Bill, why don't you make the points that you think people need to know, and then we'll continue from there.
Okay, sure. Well, look, I mean, this is a very dangerous situation for the whole planet right now, because at the same time that there is a clear full-court press as the policy of the British Empire to use Obama to unleash what really could only be ultimately done as long as this lunatic is in the White House, which is to unleash thermonuclear war on this planet, beginning with a conflict in the Middle East, you've got a situation where, one, the population is being inundated with the idea that as bad as things are, all you can really do is wait around and vote in an election months from now. And at the same time, if you look at what that election cycle presents itself as options, you have on the one hand this lunatic Obama, and on the other hand a grouping of Republicans, you know, Mitt Romney and Gingrich and these people, who are not opposing any of the things that Obama's doing, which a number of which could make the question of who becomes elected completely irrelevant. And the Democratic Party, of course, is essentially dropping all opposition, as Mr. LaRouche pointed out in this latest weekly report, they're not going to oppose Obama, even though it's becoming clearer and clearer that the policy is for a allowing Israel to basically pull us into a conflict with nations like Syria and Iran, but which in the immediate period would actually bring us in directly into conflict with Russia and China. So that's obviously extremely extremely dangerous situation, and that lack of opposition within the leadership of the Democratic Party is going to have to change, because there's the idea that if you look at the just the escalation and the back and forth, this is not a static situation in which we may just be drawn into war by accident or something like that. There's been a number of things that have happened in the last week and a half that demonstrate clearly that there is this intention to immediately, by the British Empire, to immediately get this war started now, precisely because their system is collapsing. You had a security summit in Tel Aviv recently that had wonderful people like James Woolsey participating, and people from the Cheney period, who we know as the people who cooked up all the false intelligence that got us into the Iraq war in the first place. And they were producing all sorts of very outlandish estimates to basically say that either we go and strike Iran now, or they're going to have nuclear weapons with rockets that can reach 10,000 miles and hit the United States, which, of course, is a complete, makes some of the lies that were told to get us into Iraq look like small in comparison. You also, Tony Blair himself has also been in Israel meeting constantly with Netanyahu, and David Cameron is expected to meet with Obama in a series of meetings in the beginning of March. You also had the head of the Israeli Mossad. After our Joint Chiefs of Staff was in Israel, basically warning the Israelis not to undertake a unilateral strike against Iran, the response that came from the Israelis, from their from the head of their military intelligence, came in a trip taken by the head of intelligence to the United States, in which he essentially said that Israel has a closing window of time in which they must strike Iran if they're going to be able to knock out Iran's intention to basically develop a nuclear weapon. Of course, at the same time, our own national intelligence estimate was released, which basically said that Iran has not made the decision at this point to develop a nuclear weapon. So it's a very clear picture that unless Obama is removed, there is a unmistakable intention in this immediate period of, long before the election, to unleash a war which targets China and Russia ultimately.
Bill,
as two nations that are actually expressing the very type of intention that we should remember from the Kennedy period.
Bill, if I can just interrupt from an Australian
sure.
perspective, the media here is preparing the population for this eventuality as well. So, for example, yesterday there was a lot of coverage of the fact that it's been Israel has the intention of bombing Iran in the spring, which is as early as a month away, was reported. And then I just noticed this morning that Russia and China have just vetoed a UN Security Council resolution on Syria. And the way it was reported was Russia and China are using their influence to back Syria's regime. And it makes it sound like, they're the enemy.
Right.
Right. And, you know, Robbie, I'd be interested if you would just say something brief is okay or long, but you had, on the nature of Obama, as Bill has sketched out the threat in general, the strategic threat, who's behind it, the London crowd, and you had Obama in your backyard there in Darwin and so forth on a gunboat tour in full sail, right? Like Emperor Nero, like some megalomaniacal person. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, well, he came down here just before Christmas to set up a Marine base in Darwin, or just outside of Darwin, to the north. And even though China is our biggest trading partner, and more so than that, our economy is nothing without China at the moment. We are such a colony of globalization that unless China's buying our resources, Australia has no economic activity whatsoever. So we're totally dependent on the Chinese, yet our insane schizophrenic government in league with Obama is also whipping up, we're like agents in the Asia Pacific for this, what used to be called the containment policy of China, which is obviously now much worse. It's really targeting China, and to that end, they've established this Marine base in Darwin, which, of course, in the event of a thermonuclear conflict, makes Australia a major target. So, interestingly, though, it's made a lot of Australians nervous. You know, we have this idea, and rightfully so, there's been an idea since World War II, where Australia's alliance with America began on a very good foundation with John Curtin and Franklin Roosevelt, which was, you know, Australia was the basis for a while for MacArthur's pushback against the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very important alliance, and it still is if it's an alliance for good, you know. But in the recent period, every single foolish war that the British have lured America into,
yeah,
Australia has been there every single time, and this just continues that, and we've painted a big target on ourselves.
Right, that makes sense. Well, let me, I have some things to ask Bill, but one thing, Robbie, why don't you just say right out about, you made this, you narrated this documentary that just came out, bearing on this whole international context. What were you getting at doing that? And could you give the listeners a description of it?
Well, in terms of the international context, we're trying to make people understand this question of genocide, that when the British talk about, the royal family, the crown, talks about population reduction down to from 7 billion people down to 1 billion people, they're deadly serious. As a British country in Asia, you know, a British colony which has never really ever become independent, Australia, you know, monitoring what happens in the United States politically, where, you know, LaRouche is trying to expose the nature of the British Empire and how it's the British Empire behind things, and Americans are blind to the fact that the British Empire even exists. Well, imagine yourself in Australia; it's even worse.
Oh.
We have this fraudulent idea that we're independent, and we're not, and we're actually very much a part of the British Empire. And in almost every respect, we've allowed ourselves to become agents for that empire. So, the main mechanism that the British are employing to achieve this population reduction is the Green Movement, the environmental movement. And Australia, in many respects, is an experimental ground for many of the policies that then get exported around the world.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the political Green Movement of Green parties, etc., began here in Australia. Australia was the very, very first Green Party in the world, in
really?
Tasmania, back in 1972.
Uh-huh.
And so people, we want to expose that to people, but what we want to do, more to the point, is really go after their axioms of what they believe, which allows them to accept environmentalism, even though it's committed to destroying them as people. And the axioms we've identified, which are the really broad ones in our, that we go after in our video, is this idea of the balance of nature, you know, which people get taught at grade school level, right?
Yep.
Nature's in this delicate balance. And the implication is, which started off as an implication, now it's just straight out there as propaganda, that human beings upset that balance, that delicate balance of nature. Everything's in balance until humans come along, and that becomes the justification for the mentality that we have to reduce the world's population. And then, of course, when you understand the nature of the British and you take this, you follow this idea back, you quickly get to the time when British elites, the aristocracy and their minions, were not as polite as today, and they were open about the fact that reducing the population means mass killing people off, whether through war, as Bertrand Russell advocated, or through, you know, spreading diseases and keeping people poor and in bad sanitation and hygiene conditions, as, you know, Thomas Malthus advocated 200 years ago. The British oligarchical mindset was, we have to kill people off in large numbers. And when you understand that mindset, you realise that what you're dealing with today in the British Crown is exactly what LaRouche is saying. There's no hyperbole involved here. They make decisions where they know that, you know, whether it be an environmental policy on the global warming scheme or in strategic policy on this war drive, they know that they will cause the deaths of billions of people, and they're happy about that. That is their intention.
Right. Well, let me ask, there's two lines of questioning here. Let's hold one, because Robbie, I want you to go into some of the, what you said when you go back, some of the, summarize some of the history of some of these elites that were so in your face in the past and so forth. But first, Bill, you were saying something on the recent forum on LaRouche PAC with your fellow candidates and Mr. LaRouche about raising the point that speaking of people's axioms, people have been conditioned to stay small. You said they need a change of reference. And I think you used some wild thing about squeezing the juice out of a rotten turnip is how people stay small and expect something out of these elections. I don't know. But speaking of axioms, do you want to say anything at this point about that? That why people are susceptible to this, in fact, what seems very glaring that Robbie just said?
Right. Yeah, I think it gets to the same exact point, which is that why do people accept what is so blatantly evil? Whether it be watching Obama go for a war escalation or putting up with the idea that all you can do is vote for the lesser of two evils, or even just what's underpinning all of this pessimism that you find in when people want to have just a small identity, even when things are going extremely bad. They say, well, I can't do anything about it. Plus, really, if we just remove Obama, won't we just have someone else in there who's going to be just as rotten or just as easily corrupted? And, you know, I think it does get this, obviously, was something that was, that the irony of this is that as much as people can kind of take comfort in the idea of being small and saying, well, this is just the way that the universe works, I mean, the British Empire had to put an enormous amount of effort into killing that tendency in our population, which caused people to elect a Franklin Roosevelt and a Kennedy and to fight for a future. They had to kill Kennedy. They had to they had to shut down the space program. They had to launch us into 10 years of prolonged war in Vietnam, which resolved nothing. And then they had to push a counterculture, all to kill the idea of scientific optimism, and to impose on the beliefs of the population the acceptance of the idea that the universe is this unchanging sort of thermodynamic equilibrium in which nothing fundamentally really changes, and so that the role of the individual becomes essentially irrelevant. And that is the idea of man within this empire, and I think that's why it falls upon those who really recognize just how rotten the situation is right now to fight to communicate a truthful idea about the nature of man's relationship to the universe, and to, by doing so, to really destroy any aspect and anyone who's pushing any aspect of this concept of either monetarism or the greenie ideology is just something that is actually, as it's been elaborated by The Basement recently, that which is actually determining our species' extinction. And in ridiculing it from that standpoint and forcing the question of what the real nature of mankind actually is.
That is great. I have to tell you, Bill, an image comes to my mind of some dinosaurs down there in the Antarctic, in the Southern Hemisphere, in Robbie Barwick's backyard. This current week, Al Gore, Ted Turner, there's a mission of the global warming gang. Richard Branson and 100 other people have spent the week, they're leaving today, polluting the environment down in the Antarctic.
They're trying to find where global warming went, are they?
I think so. That's what they said. They said, we're here to see firsthand. Al Gore said, I haven't been there for 22 years. I'm going to see firsthand so I can go back to the skeptics. Okay. Anyway, that isn't the level of ridicule. It's true they went down there and ruined her. But do you want to say anything, either one of you, about the response of people when, I don't know, Bill, I'm thinking of you are physically, geographically, politically in the Great Lakes region. That's not your international and national role, of course. But there's a kind of legacy reflex reaction there of people, even whatever age, of when this was once mobilized to make a huge difference in the world. Do people respond?
Well, one of the things that I've picked up on recently it is undeniable to many Democrats that Obama represents something that's absolutely, absolutely un-American. That his presidency has been a failure, that he's a disaster, and even at Democratic Party events, I'll get into discussions with people who just agree immediately that there are no qualified candidates. There are no there's no one running for president who's qualified at all.
Okay.
And the thing that's interesting is that when talking about the need to replace this currently bankrupt monetarist system with the idea of a credit system, and I guess specifically what that's going to mean as far as the need for NWAPA, the need for Arctic development, a return to manned space missions, that only this will allow us to overcome only this type of science driver program and a arsenal of democracy style, you know, World War II style mobilization will give us the margin of increase of productivity as a crash program to overcome just 30, 40 years of economic attrition under globalization. The idea of that this requires a World War II mobilization, I found, is something that among the more skilled layers of people, a number of whom, you know, come from families whose, you know, parents were involved in the World War II mobilization, they've already been discussing this. In other words, the fact that that's the only thing that could actually work right now, not just jobs, not just some, you know, idea of somehow giving someone a tax break and then you're going to have a job created.
Yeah, or only, green batteries out in Michigan. Yeah, right.
Yeah, not green jobs, not, you know, repaving roads, not, you know, tax breaks, but only a directed, returning to a directed intention like Kennedy or Roosevelt had to define a mission which involves new breakthroughs for mankind, new frontiers, that's really the only thing that could work. It's somewhat of a conscious realization that people are already have in mind, and but they you know, there's no context for it outside of the idea of a space program and what's being what we're laying out and some of what the Russians are doing right now.
When we have a similar phenomenon here. You know, when there's an election on in Australia, because politicians talk about big infrastructure projects without any intention of ever delivering them, but they know, they talk about them because they know they're very popular. Mm. You know, Australians get excited about these kind of ideas, and so they get wheeled out at election time, and nothing ever comes of them. They'll talk about, you know, very fast trains and these types of things that we've been advocating for a long time. And, of course, when the Green Movement started in Australia, by Prince Philip personally, which I can talk about a little bit later, but it was
go ahead any time you want to, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it was at the time when there were two focal points in Australia of some of the most fantastic infrastructure development you'll ever want to see, which was the 1950s and 60s construction of the Snowy Mountains project, and in Tasmania, which is this little green cult base now. Back in that period, it was building its own hydro scheme, which was even more significant in a sense than the Great Snowy Mountains project, which people around the world know about. Here's one. It was a scheme that was sort of unifying they could take an entire island and say, let's look at this as a whole, and how would we develop it? And they developed this great hydro project down there called Tas Hydro, and it was in that context that Prince Philip personally came to Australia, ordered on a royal tour in 1963, ordered his immediate lackeys here, including the Governor General, the Viceroy of the Crown here in Australia, to pull together people in science and business, for business for the money, of course, to set up a branch of his World Wildlife Fund, which had just started, and that became known as the Australian Conservation Foundation, and then. They were answering, they were writing reports back to Prince Philip of their progress. And then in the early 1970s, he came back to Australia himself. He took over the presidency of this organisation. And this is an example of how that, when LaRouche talks about the British Crown, people need to understand that they have a hands-on role here, because you'll see it in this case in Tasmania. Prince Philip, who broke all the sort of the normal rules of how the royalty is supposed to engage with the political systems of countries, he went and used his personal clout to go to Tasmania to back up all these radical Greens that had been unleashed down there and shipped in from other states, to put a stop to these types of infrastructure development projects that were underway in Tasmania. He personally directed that. It got to the extent that he flew over one of these sites called Lake Peta. He actually piloted the Royal Air Force jet himself to fly over it, landed in Hobart, visited the Premier, the leader of the state government, and they cleared the room, and there was only these two guys, and the staff outside later reported they had a shouting match. Prince Philip and his Premier had a shouting match over this Tasmanian development. He used all the clout he could to bring this to a halt. And it was a major interference in Australian political affairs by any standard. But they were determined to do it. They did it. Out of this came the world's very first Green Party. And that went on. I mean, you know, say in Germany, Petra Kelly, the woman who started the Green Party in Germany.
Right.
She was down there for that period. She was incubated in Tasmania, went back to Germany to spread it there. And from that moment on, they had a green Gestapo that could bring a halt to every major attempt in Australia to transform our environment for the good of humanity. You know, and they, you know, pretty much effectively no real major infrastructure projects in water or transport, etc., have been done to this day as a result of that.
Let me ask you something more on that, because it's so stark, and unfortunately there are many examples around the world with different particularities. But Robbie, could you say something too about the, on a world scale, what this, you having Australia being forced into a being a colony of globalization means a lot about food, and your Australia's role in export, not just for Asia, but on the world grain markets, producing wheat for the world grain markets, and lots of other things. But could you say something in particular about the immediate threat to the whole Southeast Australia, what's called the, I think it's 1/7 the entire land area of your entire continent, that from the two, the basins of the two rivers called the Murray and the Darling?
The Murray-Darling Basin.
Would you say something about that? We want to have you or someone else back in the coming weeks about the world food supply, but would you say something here in terms of the Green Gestapo and the significance of this to the world as well as your nation?
Well, it is about the significance. Australia has an enormous potential to be a food bowl for the world. We have the areas we've developed were developed because that's where they were the areas that were settled, and so there was a natural development, but they happen to be the areas in the lower part of the country with the least amount of water, and the development's quite spectacular. The Murray-Darling Basin is a miracle of development. It's one of the largest river basins in the world, but it's also one of the driest, and it's been turned into a over the course of a century, it was turned into a food bowl that could feed consistently, say, you know, 60 million people, somewhere around there. But if you take right now, in the last 18-month period, we've had a lot of rain that the Greenies, Hans Schellenhuber's buddy Tim Flannery here, prophesied 5 years ago we'd never have again under the global warming scare. We've had a lot of rain. This system, this river basin system, is teeming with water. And it could be, in the context of a world food shortage, it could right now be mobilized to produce food for millions and millions more. You know, even on a short-term basis, if it came to that, right? The water is there. It's stacks of it right now.
And you have it behind, there's in the reservoirs and so forth, right?
In the the reservoirs are naturally full. The river is swollen like you wouldn't believe, right?
Okay.
The rivers are swollen, and they've just had a stack, because we're in this La Nina weather pattern, you know, where we get the rain instead of in El Nino, we get drought. And they've just had a stack more flooding in Queensland. You'd remember friend Andrew Bailey, Marsha.
Yes.
Where Andrew was from in Charleville, his hometown has again flooded it, and that's all going to flow down. You know, all the water's there. They could use it if they wanted to. The potential's there, and of course, what the Greens have done is been determined to destroy that potential. Just before I come back to that, what I was going to say about Australia's potential overall, though, you have the top end of Australia, which is the part in the tropics, the greatest amount of Australia's rainfall happens up there, but it's undeveloped. And we could turn that into a food bowl. But about 2 years ago, the main science organisation here, which is totally dominated by eco-fascists, green fascists, and was set up by people who answered to Prince Philip personally, you know, back 16, 70 years ago, they have ruled out any development on the top end on the basis, get this, that there's not enough water. And the whole country let out an enormous snort of derision when they heard that, because they know it's the wettest part of the country.
We saw the photos 2 years ago.
Well, and here was their argument, though. Oh, yeah, in the wet season, there's plenty of water. But we make that statement on the basis that beforehand, we rule out any dam construction, mm-hmm. because we shouldn't build dams, right? So if you look at it from the standpoint of having a commitment to no dams, then there's not enough water. Anyway, so that's the mentality we're up against. In the Murray-Darling Basin in particular, like I said, over 100 years, it was developed. It's a miracle of development. Incidentally, the first real development of it was in the area of Mildura, which was started by a couple of Canadian-American brothers known as the Chafee brothers, who went on to... They'd been developing irrigation systems in California, Marsha, and then one of them, after starting this Mildura region, went back and was instrumental in the Imperial Valley. So this Mildura region was the first example where they took the river, they diverted waters into irrigation, and they made, you know, jewels in the desert. This was the Murray River, which is, Bill might remember because he visited Victoria, you know, the state of Victoria, the border is the Murray River at the top of it, at the north of it. And pretty much the whole of, or half of the stretch of that northern border before development was one cattle sheep station.
Ooh.
One. It was this enormous sheep station the sheep, it was just desert area, really. That's now been turned, that's the heart of the irrigation area of the Murray-Darling Basin. And a lot of other towns like Griffith and Deniliquin and Leeton, especially in the post-war period, we had a lot of Italian migration into Australia. A lot of people went to those regions and they created similar oases in the desert on the basis of development. It's that, for example, they're the most efficient rice growers in the world in that region. They can produce rice with the least amount of water, because it's very high technology, etc. And they can, in terms of their capacity, they can produce enough rice alone to feed 40 million people.
Ah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Most of that's been obliterated in the last decade or so. Now, we had a drought, and the droughts are, you know, unfortunately a normal occurrence in Australia. But it was not the drought that stopped the production. It was the greeny impositions to stop the use of water in the drought that stopped the production. And that whole, all these changes that were made to the Murray-Darling Basin were directed by the actual organisations that answer to Prince Philip. This Australian Conservation Foundation that he started in 63, the World Wildlife Fund Australia, and a gaggle of scientists who call themselves the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists, which is headed up by this gentleman I mentioned, Tim Flannery, who's Professor Hans Schellenhuber's counterpart in Australia. They started themselves to precisely stop the proper scientific use of, you know, water for economic development in the Murray-Darling Basin. And incidentally, the reason they started themselves, it was back in 2002. Earlier that year, the CEC, our organisation, had just put out the previous most significant edition of our newspaper before this current one, called The Infrastructure Road to Recovery, which we'd produced in conjunction with Professor Lance Endersby, who you'd probably both remember,
Yes, he visited here, and he was on one of our television shows. People should know here, he personally spent time in Colorado before he went to work on the Snowy Mountain project, and worked shoulder to shoulder with some of the FDR-era post-World War II engineers as a young man. He said, I didn't know. I was so wet behind the ears, but they said, you can go back and you can do it.
That's right. And he epitomized, in terms of his life and career, he epitomized this development era in Australia. But we met up with him back in the mid-90s because he was a professor then in the twilight of his career of engineering. And I remember the first time I ever spoke to him, he said he had put a lot of his own personal money into thinking up infrastructure projects for Australia, because he was teaching all these students civil engineering, but they were all having to take other options as well, such as commerce, because there was no real prospects for them to get jobs in engineering like there had been for him when he was graduating from university back
They
in
were
probably 40s.
Supposed to all work on toll roads, toll highways.
At best. we're world leaders in toll roads for City of London banks. But Lance had sort of creatively come up with a lot of projects himself. There's a lot of projects that were shelved, that were intended after World War II and were shelved. We dusted a lot of these off, produced a paper, and the centerpiece was a feature of 18 major water projects that could be built in Australia to harness the waters of the top end for development, improve the Murray-Darling Basin system even more, improve areas in Western Australia, which is the wheat belt of Australia, etc. And Prince Philip's World Wildlife Fund started this Wentworth group later that year, uh-huh, in their own words, to combat those ideas. So they then have had this reign of terror in the basin in particular, because they're the scientists, you know, the poor farmers who, they know how to farm, they know, they have common sense, they know how the system actually works because they work it every day. They're committed to the health of it because their livelihood depends on it, and they're food producers. When they're told, though, that the scientists say that they're damaging the environment, it's a very hard thing to argue with. And this has been a reign of terror to shut down this real jewel in the crown of Australia's economic development. So that's, and it was actually because of that issue, mm-hmm, that we produced this video that we've done, to go after that in particular. The kicker on the title is The Plot to Destroy the Murray-Darling Food Bowl, Ecosystems, a Genocidal Fraud. And, you know, it's just showing people that the idea that this basin as a whole is defined as an ecosystem, it's in very delicate balance, and we've come along and ruined it, you know, is just based on the most blatant anti-human mythology that the British Empire could muster.
Oh, I think that's clear. Let me ask you one more thing, Robbie, and in the final 10 minutes, Bill, anything you want to make sure people know about or respond to? I mean, I can ask you, too, about Nawapa or about the whole at-large scientific sense of the universe that we're operating from. But, Robbie, do you want to say one thing about this idea of, you said things should be in balance, that's where the name, and there's a whole history to the name, use of the name ecosystem. Cambridge University has a specialty in it. This was imposed. Do you want to just,
sure,
a few minutes, but sketch some of the things for people.
Well, let me first say that what the Basement and LaRouche produced,
yes,
last week,
mm-hmm,
on this Extinction of Empire idea, we conclude our video on that message, and it's a really excellent follow-up to what we've produced, because, of course, what they're presenting is the true science of how nature actually works, right, over the course of
yes,
geological time. How does the biosphere function? And when you understand that, you realize that everything humans do for the greater good, the common good, is totally in keeping with the way nature actually works.
And it's a natural idea, though. And what the British did is they determined to destroy that. So what we had been doing research ourselves, and in our paper, as you've probably seen there, Marcia, we have a very provocative article called The Second Law of Thermodynamics is a Fraud. And we mass distributed that in universities around Australia, and it really enraged a lot of people. It was very provocative, and we knew it would be. But the whole idea of ecosystems came out of this professor Arthur Tansley from Cambridge University in 1935, and it was their way of grounding any understanding of nature in the second law of thermodynamics. And the key was, Tansley had this idea that he'd picked up from, the specific idea he'd adopted from Sigmund Freud, but the foundation of it was from just the history of British science and mathematics from Newton and Darwin, which thought everything's mechanical in the British system of science. Tansley's idea was that the human mind is a machine. It's not like an internal combustion engine. He actually considered it an internal combustion engine. It's an actual machine where thought is nothing more than, you know, energy flowing through the tubes of the machine, which he called psychic energy. And he imposed that idea onto nature itself. And so he came up with the idea of ecosystems in order to define nature and the various habitats of nature as closed thermodynamic systems. And once he defined them as closed thermodynamic systems, where everything was mechanical, absolutely everything, then that justified imposing the second law of thermodynamics rules on those systems, right? And the second law of thermodynamics, of course, is all about entropy, or their term is... their preferred term is equilibrium.
Okay.
That everything is running down into an equilibrium. And Tansley called it the great universal law of equilibrium, which is the idea that the whole universe is winding down to this state where, you know, all motion ceases, and effectively, you know, the heat death idea. And he said inside that, all ecosystems naturally define their equilibrium. And that idea became the basis of what everyone accepts now as the balance of nature. You know, thanks to other British products since then, like David Attenborough and his nature documentaries, etc. In fact, I would go so far as to... I'm pretty sure you'd find, Marcia, that at university level, no professor ever proves the balance of nature. They never have to. This is an axiom that the students come into university with, because they learn it, you know, when they're 3, 4, and 5 years old. It gets drummed into them that nature's in balance. Well, it all comes back to this idea that everything's a machine. You know, life is a machine, the human mind's a machine, and if you accept that, then you accept the idea of the balance of nature. Now, most people who do accept the balance of nature would not accept, you know, naturally they would reject the idea that everything's mechanical, because they know there's a difference. Anyway, so this Arthur Tansley cooked this up. He was, his biggest influence on his life was Bertrand Russell, and that's in his own words, he said that. And of course, Bertrand Russell was one of this gang at the University of Cambridge who called themselves the Apostles, which was their sort of evil ridicule of Christianity. They were determined to destroy the ideas of Christianity, the human ideas of Christianity, and replace it with these mechanical notions, you know, because they were the oligarchy, right? They represented, they wanted to put out ideas whereby people could define themselves as, you know, machines, and deny their own creativity by which the oligarchy were able to rule over them. And Russell, of course, is... you know, he produced some of the most chilling statements you'll ever read about the explicit intention to depopulate, including this one where he, you know, decries the fact that World War II didn't kill enough people. You know, he said war's been disappointing, in killing people off. Maybe if we had bacteriological war or a Black Death through every generation. And then he said this statement that's an insight into the British Empire's mindset, which is he said that, you know, the state of affairs might be unpleasant if you have a Black Death every generation that kills off lots of people and keeps the population in balance. But he said, but what of that? Really high-minded people are oblivious to suffering, especially other people's, right? So this is the this monster is the man who influenced this Arthur Tansley. And, of course, what Arthur Tansley came up with as science was entirely in keeping with that. In fact, it followed on from that mentality and outlook. So that's what we've, you know, in our video product, we have set out to destroy that axiomatic idea, that axiom that is in people's heads. And what the basement have since done in their excellent presentation on the weekly report, which we've been using in a big way since they've produced it, is to actually show the real science of nature, so that people can sort of liberate themselves, their natural human creativity, and realize that they don't have to be subjected to this genocide.
Right, and as I say, I'll repeat again because we're nearing the end of our discussion for an hour, but this documentary and hard-hitting interventionist video you can see on the Australian website, which is www.cecaust.com.au. And then, of course, your reference to LaRouchePack.com here, where you can see this really groundbreaking, but I'm going to say inspiring, after all these rotten evil types you just went through, Robbie. People, when you look at the real principle of progress in our entire universe, these pipsqueak dinosaurs are not all powerful. So, Bill, I turn to you because somehow or other we've come all the way back around to a task you said at the beginning of bringing people into becoming humans again, seeing Obama for what he is, and these are things unfolding. Do you want to stress anything in the final minutes about the timing? And that's why I know Mr. LaRouche himself personally is giving this, I'll repeat it again, February 6th, Monday, 7 p.m. Go to LaRouchePack.com and see it live. But do you want to say anything, Bill?
Well, I would just say, actually, about this video that the CEC has produced, that I think one of the things that's most fun about it is that it really does show the lengths that these fascists, these people, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, and their acolytes, really the lengths that they had to go to actually impose a system of fascism onto the population by completely fabricating this lie of the idea that there is such that nature is fixed in the type of way that this concept of the ecosystem implies, that there is any such fixed state, that somehow that the universe is just kind of like this closed system, and so therefore human creativity, which creates, which builds, which creates new things, which brings into existence the future that didn't exist yet, that's just something that messes up nature. And I think that it does a beautiful job making clear that was something that they had to really go to great lengths to cook up and get people to accept and really, you know, concoct this whole framework. And of course that is exactly what's falling apart right now as the British monarchy is right now moving, you know, to the extreme to actually launch a thermonuclear war against China and Russia to get the level of depopulation and backwardness that they need to try to maintain their system. And if that doesn't shock people into reality to move, you know, I don't know what will. But I think it's the principle which the basement's been outlining of how the future orders the decisions that are being moved on right now, and this principle of progress versus extinction, which is just a key tool in being able to mobilize mobilize a capability for leadership that's required at the moment.
Right. I think that does bring us to an end, but I think that points us forward, and I thank you both very much. So this has been, I'll have to close out and say, this has been the February 4th, 2012 LaRue Show. So I thank Robbie Barwick from Melbourne and from the CEC, Citizens Electoral Council there, and thank you, Bill Roberts from Detroit, from the Presidency Slate of Six. Thank you so much for this time, and I invite people again, February 6th, Lyndon LaRouche, 7 p.m., LaRouchePAC.net. Thanks again. Okay, bye-bye.